This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 270, was recorded on May 6th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole, and by Masterworks.io, bringing fine art investing within reach of all investors. Dylan Grice, formerly of SocGen fame and now co-founder of Calderwood Capital, joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss everything from inflation versus deflation to how far bond yields can go to the outlook for asset markets. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick has prepared a slide deck titled Sector Rotation or Start of Bigger Correction? We'll have that right after the feature interview.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's just jump to that S&P 500, which up about 9 points at the time of recording. We're at 4170. Really, it's just the market's been more or less sideways for several weeks now after approaching 4200. You think this is just a consolidation in your mind?
You know, to me, anything that's above the 50-day moving average is just noise. This market has really, I think, ignored a lot of fundamentals and charged higher, and I think it's going to continue doing exactly that. And I do think it's more crack-up boom than fundamentals-driven, but I don't see any reason not to expect higher numbers.
Well, Eric, we can take a deeper dive into that in the post game when I have some charts that kind of covers the topic of how these sectors are breaking down. So let's move on to that U.S. dollar, which really continues to just muddle along. Like, it's been more or less distributive over the last month. We're at about the 91 handle, and just it doesn't seem like the dollar wants to do anything with any conviction. What do you think's in store for the dollar from here?
Well, as you say, Patrick, we're still consolidating sideways. And that's the way I look at this chart. I look at that whole month-long excursion above 92 is really just probably a short squeeze-induced anomaly. I think we're really in a sideways consolidation that's going to last however long it's going to last and doesn't really show any signs of changing right now.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because crude approached those February-March highs near $67, and we've a little bit of selling here. We're about 65 at the time of recording. What's your take here on crude? Do you think it's just going to keep plowing higher?
Well, Patrick, it was the API inventory report that really kind of got things going on Tuesday afternoon. They called for a big drawdown on crude oil inventories, about three times bigger than consensus analyst expectations. That really got the party going with a big move to the upside this week in crude oil. It was mostly all ahead of inventory, though, ahead of the official EIA inventory. When EIA inventory came out, sure enough, they confirmed an 8 million barrel draw on crude oil inventories. That would actually be 9 million if you included the additional 1 million that came out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Cushing, Oklahoma building 254,000 barrels. Gasoline building 737,000 barrels. Distillates drawing down 2.9 million barrels, with U.S. production holding steady at 10.9 million barrels. Overall, Patrick, at the time that the data came out, I think by then the market was already above the trend resistance line. It was overbought, and by the time the data came out, it was a sell the news event, and it's been selling off since then. But I think this is just a case of the market catching its breath. We're back down to the five-day moving average as we speak now on Thursday afternoon, just about exactly on it at 64 spot 84. And I think this is still a strong uptrend. I think we're headed back to probably find some resistance at the previous high around $68. Eventually, we'll get through it. That puts 70 in the sights. And once we get a close over 71 or so, then 75 comes into view. And then I think 80 by the end of summer. I do have a scenario, Patrick, where I think we could go much higher, like $147 a barrel plus, new highs, all-time highs. But that would require a number of factors kind of lining up together. And I think it would probably be more like in the summer of 2022 rather than this summer that I would see maybe a really big upside excursion in oil prices. But I think we're headed for 80 this summer and probably higher than that.
All right, well, let's move on to gold because we broke out of that multi-week consolidation and above 1,800 where that 200-day moving average was. Is this breakout in gold legit in your mind?
Well, I'm looking at my notes here, Patrick, and what I had planned to say today is gold has just one more thing to do in order to really lock in the story that this is a confirmed new uptrend, and that is to get above the 100-day moving average and have a closing print there. Sure enough, we got that today, and it was a very decisive one. It's not only above the 100-day moving average at 1,800, but it's like 15 bucks above it. It's not right on the line or anything. So it was a very decisive breakout. At this point, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a little bit of relief selling to go back down and test that 1800 as a support level. And then I would expect to see new highs to happen from there. So I think we're headed higher in gold. The one caveat I have to throw out is if it turns out that it's not over for the 10-year treasury yield and we start seeing the 10-year yield back up over 2%, that's going to change everything, and I think we'll be plumbing new lows for gold. But shy of something going wrong with the 10-year, I think it's all up from here.
Well, since you're talking about the 10-year yield, let's touch on that. I mean, we're trading around 1.57 right now on the yield, and more or less, and it really hasn't moved much in the last couple of weeks, in spite of a pretty strong commodity rally and some inflation pressures. Really, the 10-year yield doesn't seem to want to get anything going. What's your take on it over here?
Well, it seems like at least we've found where the comfort zone is. It seems like below 1.6, and we're just barely below 1.6 now. It seems to be where the market's finding that comfy zone, where people are not freaking out and everything's happy. As soon as we get above 1.7 or so, people start freaking out, and other markets like gold and stock market starts to take a nosedive. So it seems like we know kind of that 1.7 is about where the red line in the sand is. I really have no idea what's going to happen next. And I'm finding that the more I ask different macro analysts, I don't think anybody's really sure exactly what comes next. I'm not hearing a lot of conviction about directional calls people are making on where the 10-year is headed from here. And I don't have one myself. So I guess we'll see what happens.
This week's feature interview guest is Calderwood Capital founder Dylan Grice. Now, Eric, why did we invite Dylan on the show this week?
Well, Dylan's name has been really big in macro since his days as an analyst at SocGen, Societe Generale. And he's since had a couple of other positions, and then he went to launch his own fund and co-founded Calderwood. Really smart guy. Had never had him on Macro Voices before. He's kind of one of those names where you kind of come across and say, how the heck did we never invite this guy? So we decided to give him a shot.
Well, Eric's interview with Dylan Grice is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies. In addition to sponsoring Macro Voices, Abex also produces Smarter Markets, a weekly podcast that airs every Saturday morning on Spotify, YouTube, and all the other major podcast platforms. Smarter Markets brings together the leading minds in macroeconomics, technology, and commodities to explore how capital markets can be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. Todd Buchholz's inaugural episode of the podcast with Stefan Weiler is available on smartermarketspod.com now, and Todd will be back on Saturday morning with Arjun Murthy as we continue to explore the transition to carbon neutrality. Arjun has been analyzing the global energy sector for nearly 30 years and spent over 20 years as an equity research analyst and partner at Goldman Sachs. But you won't find Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to receive this free podcast.
And And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Dylan Grice, who's probably best known from his days at SocGen, but these days he's co-founder of Calderwood Capital. Dylan, great to have you. First time on the show. Let's start with a question I've been asking just about everybody, which is, boy, all of our favorite deflationists have turned into not just inflationists, but many of them secular inflationists who really say this is maybe another late 60s, early 70s beginning of a big event. Would you agree with that? And if so, what are you doing about it?
Well, hello, Eric, and thanks for the big opening question. It's a tough one. So to kind of rewind for 10 years, to be brutally honest, I was very much in the kind of structural inflation camp. I was very much of the opinion that we were about to see the whites of inflation's eyes, and that it was going to be the defining characteristic of financial market behavior, really, across the asset classes. It was going to be the driver of asset returns, really, over the next decade. Of course, I was thinking this in 2010. And I was writing about it a lot. And the fact is, I was completely wrong. And so I'm kind of very hesitant to make the same mistake again. And I think, I look back on it and I look at some of my reasoning 10 years ago when I kind of thought that, you know, inflation was about to take off. I actually kind of retraced my steps and I reread some of the stuff that I wrote. And what I actually said was, so back in 2010, the one I remember, the prediction that I remember making that I wrote, I said, in 10 years' time, we will be looking at the whites of the eyes of an inflation problem. And not an inflation, not by 100 or 200 basis points, but inflation which is becoming uncontrolled, inflation which is getting out of control. And so inflation of a kind of 4 to 5% rate and a rate which was accelerating, right? So that was my kind of prediction in 2010 for what the world in 2020 would look like. And kind of pandemic aside, 10-year break-evens were 50 basis points lower on the eve of the pandemic than they were when I was making my prediction. So I was just horribly, horribly wrong. And I think, you know, you got to kind of try and understand why you were so wrong before you try and make, you know, the same prediction again. So, you know, I guess the kind of the summary answer is I don't really know. The simple answer is I'm not quite sure.
Well, I was reading your work, Dylan, in 2010, and I agreed with you emphatically, and we were both emphatically wrong together as a result. So, you know, here we are, and it seems to me that at this point, the evidence is just so overwhelmingly clear that we're headed toward a secular inflation event. But, you know, I kind of thought that 10 years ago, too, and we both got it wrong. So what do you do from a process standpoint when, you know, you know you've got a really important view on the market that happens to be the same one that you got really badly wrong not that long ago?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And I think, you know, how do you build a portfolio on the assumption that some of your key inputs might be completely wrong? In other words, how do you build a portfolio which is robust to your ignorance? So that's kind of, you know, that's what we tried to do at Calderwood. That's what I've been doing really for the last kind of 7 or 8 years at the family office. I kind of, when I left SocGen, I went to work at a family office in Switzerland, one of the largest family offices in Europe. And I kind of helped establish their liquid investment decision. And the kind of starting point for our investment process was really one of accepting your ignorance and not trying to, which I think is very consistent with the capital preservation mentality, right? So if you're trying to, you know, if you're trying to kind of 10x or 20x or 100x your money, then that's a different kind of mindset. You know, you're actually making bets on things that you think you know because you're trying to get rich. Whereas when you're in a kind of family office and you're helping to build a family office, the family's already rich. They just don't want to be poor. So it's not the focus isn't trying to kind of 10 or 20 or 30x the capital. The focus is on, you know, maintaining its real purchasing power, first and foremost. And secondly, hopefully growing that purchasing power in real terms. But it's a different mindset. And the mindset, as I said, the starting point is ignorance. So I think if you're doing that properly, it shouldn't really matter whether you get inflation right or wrong, right? And so that's kind of where we're at, you know, from a money management perspective. In terms of your, to answer your kind of question on, you know, specifically on inflation, you said that today it's more compelling now than it even was then. And I completely hear you and completely understand. But I think that there's just something about, we clearly don't understand inflation as well as we think. And by the way, that's not just guys like us who've got it wrong, right? That's not just the guys who saw QE, you know, put two and two together and came up with seven and got completely the wrong answer, right? I think what that episode demonstrates is that people just, you know, guys like us didn't understand inflation as well as we thought, right? But you can flip it over. And I think that a lot of the MMT guys and girls, Stephanie Gelton, for example, their kind of premise is that they do understand inflation, right? Their premise is that we can spend all this money, we can print all this money, and we can print this money, and we can do lots of good stuff with this printed money, and it's not going to cause inflation, right? Because we just know, because look, it hasn't caused inflation in the past, so it's not going to cause inflation in the future. So they're the ones who, you know, equally, I think that they're also deluding themselves into thinking that they understand inflation. And I think that maybe an advantage that we have, or certainly an advantage I feel I have, is that I actually kind of know that I don't understand it, and I can kind of build a portfolio that doesn't need me to understand it, right? I just have to understand that it's a risk that may or may not materialize.
Well, it seems to me like what we know is pretty clear, which is that there is a huge amount of fiscal stimulus and money being created. The mistake we made last time was that QE was creating bank reserves that didn't really go into the real economy and create competitive demand for goods and services. It seems pretty darn clear to me that the list of people that are being offered handouts of some kind, transfer payments, some kind of stimulus support is pretty darn long. And there are not conditions attached to what you have to spend the money on. You know, you get your stimulus check, you can spend it on whatever you want to spend it on. So it seems pretty darn clear to me. But, you know, as you say, we we were kind of wrong last time. What do you do? Are you a big investor in inflation hedges like gold and crypto and other things that people who are inflationists invest in? Or how do you approach it?
Yeah, you know, that's a really, really good question. I mean, so the simple answer is, yes, I agree with you, right? This kind of money is actually going into people's pockets, whereas before it was going into the financial system, i.e. bankers' pockets, and it was also going into rich people's pockets, right? Because it was inflating asset prices, although there's plenty of that this time around as well, right? But yes, you're actually kind of helicopter dropping money into people's bank accounts, and that's different. And ultimately, I think, you know, if you can conduct a kind of thought experiment, this kind of idea that central banks can't create inflation, which you hear a lot of and you used to hear a lot of, it's, you know, I've always had a problem with that argument. Because if you just think of a following thought experiment, suppose you put $1 billion into every American's bank account, right? You printed $1 billion for every single bank account. What do you think would happen to inflation, right? Obviously, it's going to go up, right? It has to be, right? And then you say, well, that's obviously stupid because they would never do that. And you say, okay, well, suppose it wasn't $1 billion. Suppose it was 1 million, right? And then you say, well, now what do you think the effect would be? Do you think the effect would be inflationary or not? And of course, the answer would be inflationary, right? You know, people would just suddenly start going out and spending money, and there wouldn't be the kind of supply to meet that demand. And so prices would go up. And then, but you know, people say, well, you know, they're not going to do 1 million either, right? And then you say, well, okay, well, you know, what if it's 500,000? Or what if it's 100,000? Or what if it, you know, at some point it has to become inflationary. And so we've now opened up that door, and we're now walking down that path. And I'm not quite sure what the way back is from it. That's now become a policy tool. So I totally agree with you that does actually, that's a tick in the box for the inflationists, that's going to be inflationary. And then the second thing is, well, even if it's not inflationary this time round, then there's no constraint on them doing it even more next time round. So they do even more. So, you know, where's the constraint on this? And the answer is, I don't think there really is much of a constraint. And so I totally get the inflationists' argument and their fears. And frankly, I have huge, huge sympathy with them. But I think that the irony is that what that means is the inflation trade, if you like, or the inflation protection is kind of easy, right? I don't think it's difficult to get inflation protection in your portfolio, right? As you said, gold, crypto, you know, some fund advisor gave feedback on our fund and they said that they didn't think our fund was worth it because you could get inflation protection from inflation protected treasuries, right? So, you know, okay, you're locking in a negative return. If you buy TIPS today, what's the yield? It was negative 70, negative 80 basis points on the 10-year, I think. So that's a guaranteed loss of purchasing power if you buy TIPS. So, you know, the arguably the inflation hedges, they're easy to get, but they're arguably quite expensive, right? They're not that attractive. So I think you have to think kind of carefully about what you're doing there. So that's the first point. The second is, you know, in the 1970s, during a kind of stagflation, you get recessions as well as inflations. And so you want that. You still actually want some kind of protection for that deflationary tail, right? You know, when you see a market crash or a market event, what that is typically pricing in is some kind of recession or some kind of credit event or some kind of depression. So in other words, these kind of left side tails are kind of pricing in, you know, they're pricing in deflation. And so if you want tail protection and tail hedging, what you're also saying is you want deflation hedging. And so that's actually a difficult thing to get. And so in terms of the challenge of building a portfolio, the kind of inflation deflation argument, I don't actually think it's as difficult or as fruitful because of ultimately, you know, we're all guessing. The question is, well, okay, what is the inflation trade, or what's the tail protection? I think that's, you know, that's a more difficult one to answer. I'm not sure I've got good answers to it, by the way, but I think that's a more difficult question.
Well, since we've taken the unusual approach, Dylan, of starting this interview talking about things we're clueless about, let's move on to treasury yields. Something that, I mean, I can tell you unequivocally that the U.S. 10-year yield is the most important thing to figure out in the world of macro right now today. I personally have no clue where it's headed next. Do you?
No, I don't. But I think that, you know, there's a kind of a pretty obvious asymmetry, right? I mean, I said that the thing that actually kind of engages me or has engaged me and my partners for the last few years is, you know, what does the world look like when you have a bear market in bonds? And I don't just mean, you know, over the last, you know, last quarter, which was a big move, right? You know, we saw a very big quarterly move, I think 80 odd basis points, and the 10-year was actually an outlier. If you go back kind of, you know, 120 odd years of data, it was kind of, I think it was third percentile or something like that, third or fourth percentile. So that was a big move. But that's not a bear market, right? That's just a bad quarter. A bear market is when you say, well, you know, in 5 years' time, the 10-year treasury yield will be 5%, you know, and 10 years after that, it will be 15%. And 10 years after that, it would be 25%. In other words, a structural bear market, which is grinds higher, sees yields grinding higher and higher, and really kind of defines this, you know, the current generation and the up-and-coming financial generation's careers, right? That's the kind of bear market that you're talking about. And in terms of the kind of the probability distribution of what happens, the range of outcomes, clearly, you're not going to get, in 20 years' time, I'm willing to bet quite a lot of money that you're not going to see minus 20% yields, right? But I do think there's a very good chance you'll see plus 20% yields. So it's massively skewed. And I think it kind of bothers me, really. It does. I think it's quite scary to think about what, you know, what do you think the equity market looks like when government bonds are at 20%? You know, what do these private equity funds, what do their IRRs look like when you're looking at a 20% bond yield, right, on the journey to that 20%. What's venture IRRs? What do they look like in, you know, in this kind of world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Where's real estate? You know, I think that that's kind of quite a kind of worrying idea. I think if you're not thinking about how to protect it, you know, and you're a fiduciary or something, you're not really doing your job properly, frankly.
Dylan, you recently penned an article saying that there is plenty of room for a big rally in crude oil. I happen to agree with you, but I'm very curious to get your reasons.
Well, you've just seen a complete collapse in capacity. You've seen a collapse in capex. You know, so I think that the oil markets are going to be incredibly tight, basically, over the next few years. And that tightness, I think, is something which is going to really bite. You know, the oil markets haven't recovered since that the shale gale, really, of kind of, you know, 14. And just as they were getting back on their feet, you know, kind of 18, 19, they got hit by the pandemic. And, you know, negative crude prices, you know, was the kind of the poster for just how kind of crazy that time was. You know, there has been absolutely no investment in the supply chain. I think CapEx is probably about half what it was pre-shale gale. Even the shale guys, who are kind of notoriously poor capital allocators, are kind of saying that they've now got this kind of new religion, which is kind of shareholder value. And they've kind of realized that, you know, shareholder value isn't the same as kind of, you know, drilling at every opportunity. So I think there's been this kind of change in the mindset and the kind of swing players. And just more kind of prosaically, there's just not going to be the supply to really meet future demand. And then, so that's why I think you get higher crude prices from here. I think in the kind of markets, like in the stock market, you know, or you know, private markets and credit markets, obviously there's this whole kind of move towards the energy transition, and obviously that's a thing. And so I think people have been very, very quick to kind of conclude that oil demand is growth is going to be a thing of the past, and that oil is kind of yesterday's commodity. And I think it's kind of difficult really to see that, certainly on a 10-year view. I think that you're probably going to see more oil vehicles on the road over the next 10 years rather than less. So in fact, if you actually back out Bloomberg's numbers from Bloomberg's kind of new energy finance survey, I think the implied kind of growth rate for combustible passenger vehicles is something like 70 basis points a year annualized over the next 10 years. So in 10 years' time, there's going to be more petrol-fueled passenger cars, not less. And of course, you've still got heavy-duty trucks. So there's no, you know, non-hydrocarbon solution for trucks, for heavy-duty vehicles, and you still got petrochemicals. So, you know, and by the way, I'm not saying that this is a good thing, right? That's just what it is. But oil demand is going to grow from here. So you've got growing oil demand at a time when you've had an absolute collapse in the capacity of the supply chain. So that's, you know, I think that's, you know, we need more, the world needs more oil supply capacity. And the only way you get that is with higher prices. So I think it's a pretty standard commodity cycle, really.
Yeah, this is something that fascinates me quite a bit. You know, I think there's no doubt that we are in the beginning of a process that takes us to decarbonization and eliminating the need to operate vehicles with fuels that are derived from petroleum. But boy, you talk about people in mass underestimating the size of a transition. And I can't believe, you know, people are talking about 5 years from now, there won't be any more vehicles, you know, oil or gasoline or diesel driven vehicles. I think this is going to take longer than anybody takes. And particularly what I don't hear any public discussion about is the necessary build out of the electric grid that would be required in order to support all these electric vehicles people think are coming tomorrow morning. How do you see this playing out? And what are the gotchas, things like the build out of the electric grid that nobody's talking about that maybe you're seeing that other people aren't?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not sure that we have any kind of great insight into the kind of specifics of the energy infrastructure, to be honest. You know, we've got some kind of, we've looked at a lot of energy. So we're a fund of funds, right? So we look at across the whole kind of spectrum. But we've looked at a lot of kind of energy specific managers, but they're typically very niche and, you know, very kind of narrow domain kind of sectors of the energy market. And, So I'll kind of make that excuse before I kind of give my answer. I suppose the conclusion we've reached is that I think there's just probably more broadly than just oil. I think we're looking at the commodity bull market you know, again, because what we've seen really since the kind of the GFC, and certainly since the collapse of 2014, has been this real collapse in capacity. It's not just true in oil, but it's true in most commodity markets. I mean, uranium, I think, is a kind of obvious decarbonization one that I think is very, very interesting. But just more generally, I think that we're probably looking at a commodity bull market. And, you know, for the batteries that are going to need to be built, for the grid infrastructure that's going to need to be built. So I think that that's kind of, you know, in terms of making bets on the future, you know, that would be one that. And obviously, I've just kind of spent time talking about how we try not to make those bets in the future. But if we can kind of put ourselves in a position where if that happens, we're going to do well, and if it doesn't, we're still going to be okay. That would be one of those areas. One of those, the commodity markets more generally, I think, are probably set for. You know, I mean, they're already on fire at the moment, but I think that they're set for probably a kind of multi-year bull run from here.
I want to pick up on the way you've said a couple of times that you really try to focus on not making assumptions or making bets on things. If you kind of feel like inflation is where we're headed, but you don't want to place that bet because you could be wrong, and you don't want to make the wrong bet on electric vehicles because you could be wrong, what do you end up doing in a portfolio then?
Right.
If you're trying to avoid a directional commitment?
So maybe I haven't been articulating it maybe as clearly as I should. It's not that we try and avoid the bet, because you, frankly, you can't avoid the bet, right? You know, it's like you can't avoid risk. If you get out of bed in the morning, you're taking risk, right? But of course, if you stay in bed, then you're just taking a different kind of risk. You spend the rest of your life in bed and you're risking all sorts of kind of, you know, muscle atrophy and certain diseases and, you know, horrible stuff. So there's no way to avoid risk. And so there's no real way to avoid certain bets. What I'm actually saying is that we're kind of looking for just very, very skewed return profiles. So the way I kind of think about the portfolio, suppose you want to take a bet on, all right, you know, we've talked about inflation, and I think, you know, we're on the same page. We think it's something that we're both worried about. Suppose we both want to take that bet on inflation. Well, we could say, you know, here's the obvious thing, right? Inflation's going to go up. Yields are going to go up. We're going to enter a bear market in duration. Why don't we just short government bonds from here, right? We'll short treasuries, you know, we'll short JGBs or something, okay? And actually, maybe JGB is not the best example. We'll short treasuries from here. The problem with that is if we get it wrong, we're going to lose money, right? If we get it right, fantastic. We're going to be heroes. And I'm sure in 5 or 10 years' time, there will be plenty of heroes who got that call right. But the problem is there's plenty of people who've been putting that trade on who've ended their careers or who've got themselves into trouble because they have been wrong, right? Because it's actually quite a symmetric bet, right? If you're right on inflation, you're going to make a lot of money. But if you're wrong on inflation, you're going to lose a lot of money. So the typical way to get around that is some kind of derivative structure where you've got the option, right? So you buy an option. The problem is you buy options, you have to pay the premium, right? So, and typically the premium is priced so that it's actually quite difficult to make that money consistently by just buying options all the time, right? The guys who make the money from options are the people who are selling the options typically. So it's just, how do you have your cake and eat it? How do you get yourself in a position where you say, well, okay, if inflation rips from here, we're going to be fine, right? We're actually going to do pretty well. But if inflation doesn't rip from here, we're still going to be fine, right? We're still going to do quite well. And I think that's what we try to do. And I think that's the challenge. That's where the intellectual challenge becomes, you know, a bit more interesting. You know, anyone can buy gold or go short gold if they're a deflationist. Anyone can do that, but it's very symmetric, right? You know, building in the asymmetry, I think, is much more interesting. So that's what I meant.
And where do you see the most opportune asymmetric trades in the market right now?
Well, it's not necessarily a trade so much as a strategy, right? You know, I said we're fund of funds. So we invest in different types of managers and they do different types of things. And, you know, if you kind of think about the types of managers we invest in, you say, well, you know, you've said you don't want duration in your portfolio, right? So you don't want any fixed income. And actually, if you kind of broaden out that idea with kind of tips at, you know, a negative yield, right? Because it's not just that nominal duration has been on a tear, but real duration. It's actually been real duration. Inflation expectations have been quite stable, you know, over the last 10 to 15 years, arguably actually over the last 20 years. So the bull market has been in real duration, right? Not nominal, not just nominal duration. It's been in real duration. And it's gone to such an extent that real yields are now negative in the inflation protected securities market. So suppose you say, well, we don't just want nominal duration. We don't want any real duration either. Okay, well, that means we don't have any nominal fixed income. We don't have any government bonds. We don't have any corporate bonds. We don't have any credit, really, certainly fixed income credit. But we don't have any real duration either. Well, that's equities, right? And it's obviously TIPS. But if we are saying we don't want any real duration in the portfolio, we don't want any nominal duration, we're also saying we're worried about inflation risk, right? We're worried about duration risk here, right? This is not a train that we want to be on. But if we don't want to take that risk, that means we can't take equities, we can't take credit, we can't take government bonds, we can't take anything that looks like those things. So we can't take private equity, we can't take venture, we can't take long short equity, we can't take event driven, right? We can't take kind of vanilla structured credit because that's all basically just equity in disguise, right? We can't take risk arbitrage. We can't. And you're like, well, hang on, what can you take? Because you just named, you know, 85% of the alternative investments universe, right? So that leaves us with that, I don't know, 15% of the alternative investment universe, which isn't any of those things. So that's kind of what we do, right? And if you get, you know, once you start thinking in those terms, it leads you kind of down a, you know, it leads you on a particular path that we've been on for a few years now. And that is, as I said, it is kind of hedge funds. It is niche strategies. It's very, very high expertise, narrow domain managers who frankly don't know a whole lot about much, but they really, really know what they do inside out. And it allows us to kind of create a very kind of idiosyncratic portfolio, really, as well, a portfolio of very kind of orthogonal idiosyncratic risks. But, you know, we get to be very precise about the risk we want to take. So if we don't want to take duration risk, we don't take duration risk, right? And so, you know, that's, I don't know if that answers your question. I'll kind of stop there. But that's how we do it. It's not the trade. It's what's the strategy or what's the portfolio construction strategy. That's how we answered the question.
Dylan, since you're in Europe, I want to get your perspective on the ECB under its new management and just big picture. Where are we headed in terms of what I think is a competitive devaluation between central banks? But where do you think central bank policy is headed globally from here in this new era that we have with new leadership in both the ECB and the Fed?
I think these things typically move in tandem. And, you know, one of the things I found quite kind of astonishing, I know your question was on the ECB, but just to kind of kick off with the Fed, because I think the ECB is really kind of, like Lagarde, I think in many ways is echoing Powell. But Powell really kind of set the running, I think it was at Jackson Hole last year when he really made a big thing about how he thought it was their job to do more good in the economy and to do more good in society. So I don't know if you know, saw or if you kind of how much you read from directly on his speeches, but he made a big deal about how, you know, the problem of unemployment is unevenly distributed and it particularly hurts disadvantaged minority communities. And he saw it as the Fed's role to really, really ride to their rescue. And so part of his kind of thinking is that unemployment needs to be lower and the Fed therefore need to drive unemployment much lower than it has been in the past, because this is the way that the Fed can really help these disadvantaged, poorer minority communities, right? So there was this kind of social aspect to Fed policy, political motivation to Fed policy, that you're kind of seeing. And I just kind of feel, obviously he's been more explicit, but I think Lagarde is, she's a politician. She's a former, I think, French finance minister. She's been at the IMF. She's political. She's intensely political. And I just feel that we're seeing a kind of echo of Powell's sentiments at the ECB, really. I feel that we're actually just seeing a huge kind of policy mistake, a global kind of policy mistake being led by the Fed. But I think all the other central banks are kind of falling into line. And that policy mistake is kind of hiding from making the big decisions, hiding behind the CPI and hiding behind this idea that the CPI is not a problem. So, you know, policy's fine. The CPI is not ripping here. So, you know, so everything's going to be fine. You know, CPI is still, you know, roughly 2% or 1.5% or whatever. And therefore, the fact that credit spreads are like crazy tights, the fact that underwriting is being done on crazy terms, the fact that you've got signs of froth and excess in pretty much every market you look at, whether it's SPAC markets, crypto markets, credit market, none of that matters. We don't have to pay attention to that because the CPI is just fine. I think that's the kind of policy mistake that we're seeing at the moment.
Let's come back to what you said about the ECB and the Fed both becoming politicalized or politicized, I guess is the word. Christine Lagarde has made comments. I make the joke, you know, the Fed has a dual mandate of steady employment and so forth. I think the ECB has taken up a dual mandate of solving climate change and racial inequality.
Yeah,
and she's almost come out and said that, not quite, but pretty darn close. It sounds like you and I agree that there's a trend here, which is there are politicians, people like Jerome Powell and Christine Lagarde, who are politicians at heart, who are in positions where they really ought to be focusing on the ball that's in front of their face, which is the economy. But as a politician, they know what's appealing right now to reach out. And, you know, if you're trying to win political points, you definitely want to do it on social justice in some way. And they're somehow, you know, there's this charter or mission scope drift that's going on where central bankers are saying, you know, I might be a central banker, but at the end of the day, I'm a politician, and politicians always look for the social justice win they can make in order to be more popular politicians. What are the risks of our central banks turning into politically motivated mouthpieces, if you will, for politicians, which is what these people really are?
I mean, to actually kind of go back to one of the things we were talking about earlier, which is inflation risk, and kind of wary of sounding like, you know, all roads lead to Rome, all roads lead to inflation risk discussion. But, you know, when I did go back, I said, you know, I was kind of confident that we were in the foothills of an inflation crisis, you know, 10 years ago. And, you know, and here we are. We still haven't seen it. So I went back and I tried to try and pick apart my thinking and what I'd got wrong. And one of the things that I'd really kind of underestimated was it was the role of central bank independence, right? And, you know, the notion that more money printing must invariably lead to higher inflation, like next year or the year after, because historically it has been, or there were plenty of episodes historically where that had been the case. In previous episodes where that had been the case, the central banks were run really badly, like really, really badly. And certainly in the UK, the central banks were overtly nationalized, right? And so it wasn't the central bank that set interest rates. The central bank was basically just, you know, the central bank governor was basically just a guy pulling the lever whenever the finance minister, the chancellor, exec in the UK, told him to, right? So it was the finance ministry, it was the chancellor who decided when to change interest rates. And of course, the chancellor was a politician. He was an elected politician. And it was a huge advantage to the incumbent prime minister or to the incumbent political party in the UK that you controlled interest rates, because what you could do is you would basically keep interest rates too low in the run-up to an election, because obviously you would create that feel-good factor, and the feel-good factor typically benefited the incumbent. So once you'd won the election, once you'd kept interest rates too low, you won the election, the economy's overheating, inflation's rising, then you jack up interest rates, and then you create a recession because you think, well, obviously this is going to hurt and everyone's going to be really irritated and annoyed at us, but they can't vote for another 4 or 5 years. So we might as well get it out of the way now. In other words, there was a huge political cycle in interest rate setting. And arguably, the political cycle was the dominant cycle. It was the dominant kind of informational input into interest rate setting, right? So the political cycle of interest rates, I think, was one of the real reasons why you had such an inflation problem in the 70s. And the removal of that was that the removal of that political interference was one of the reasons why I think inflation actually went on this secular downward path. And I think if you reread the literature of the 70s and 80s on central bank independence and inflation targeting, I think it's kind of obvious that that had just such a hugely powerful effect on the kind of the structure of inflation expectation setting and the structure of interest rate setting, the dynamic of interest rate setting. And I think that that really, because the underlying idea is that, which I think is true, is that economies are fundamentally deflationary, right? You know, it's part of the human condition to try and do more with less, right? Ever since some caveman or Neanderthal picked up a spear and kind of threw it at an animal, he was trying to do more with less because it was much easier to throw the spear than it was to chase the animal. And then when he put some kind of a piece of flint and sharpened flint on the end of that stick, you know, and so on and so forth. So I think it's very much who we are. We try and do more with less. And that's basically, in modern terms, that's deflation. So the economy is deflationary. And by the way, you know, yes, I've never really quite understood this fixation with deflation being this terrible thing that we all have to be really scared of. Anyway, if the default position of an economy is deflation, when you introduce this political calculus into interest rate setting, then you start to create inflation. So I think the removal of that political calculus, which is what we saw with central bank independence, is really what allowed economies to start behaving a bit more like their usual selves, which is kind of, you know, deflation machines. So that's the kind of first part to this kind of politicization of central banks. What does it mean that the central banks have, I think we now have virtue signaling central banks, certainly for the first time, maybe in history. In other words, we have highly politicized central banks who are trying to achieve political goals. I think that this is a huge step backwards. And I think that this undoes a lot of the benefits to having an independent central bank, because Greenspan was clearly political. Any notion that Greenspan was not a politician, you know, I actually once had a dinner with Sebastian Mallaby, who wrote the biography in Greenspan. He spent 4 years with the guy, and someone at the table said, you know, what's the one thing you've learned about Greenspan that that you didn't know before and that you think would really surprise people? And he said, you know, straight off the bat, the one thing that people don't understand about Greenspan is that they all think he's some kind of technocrat economist. He's a politician. He's ultimately deeply political. He loves Washington. He loves the power. And so central banking, Bernanke was exactly the same. I think that central banking attracts that type of personality. And increasingly with this virtue signaling that you're seeing in the ECB or at the Fed, I think that you're actually seeing the renewed politicization of central bank calculation. And therefore, I think that that ultimately creates a kind of inflationary impetus into kind of policy setting. So very long-winded answer, but I think that's where it does ultimately make me much more nervous about inflation. And I think even aware of the mistakes I made 10 years ago, you know, I can see how this is a new piece of information. The growing politicization of central banks and this new unconstrained tool of the printing press, this is, you know, I think this is a new data point that we didn't have 10 years ago.
Dylan, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to talk about Popular Delusions, the newsletter that you write. This is one of the better ones. It's not a free one, unfortunately. I guess some of your investors in your fund get it for free, but you do have to subscribe. We got a free sample for our Macro Voices listeners. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not registered. Just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads above Dylan's picture. Dylan, tell us about Popular Delusions, what it is, what people can expect to find there.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, as I said, I think we see a lot of very interesting stuff in financial markets. You know, as you know, we, you know, our primary focus is in running the fund. We invest in very niche strategies, very niche managers. And so kind of informationally, we're a very kind of, we sit at a very interesting juncture. You know, we, anything from, you know, we're active in reinsurance markets, life insurance markets, synthetic credit markets, private credit markets, cryptocurrency markets, litigation market, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, a whole bunch of other stuff as well. And of course, we kind of pay attention to the more vanilla asset classes. We're very kind of, a lot of our subscribers are institutional asset managers. So we're kind of, I think that we've set a very interesting kind of informational vantage point. And we write about it. We write about what we see in the fund. We write about some of the opportunities. It is geared towards actionable investment ideas, right? So it's more than just a kind of commentary on, you know, whether we think that central banks are, you know, doing the right thing or not, or any of that, these kind of higher level conversations, which is why we do actually charge for it and don't give it out for free. But we leverage really the research that goes into the fund and we publish it so that even people who don't invest in the fund can still get access to our thinking and you know, hopefully get some value from that.
And the sample issue here has both an article about uranium as well as an article about what will happen if Treasury yields continue backing up and will it burst or derail the bubble in equities. Dylan, for people who are interested either investing in your fund for accredited investors or just contacting you if they want to subscribe to the newsletter, how should they do so?
Well, the easiest way to get hold of me is on Twitter. So, you know, I'm there, Dylan Grice. I think you should be able to find me easily enough. I'm kind of in and out. I'm not super active on it, but I'm active enough to reply to messages, you know, pretty quickly.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to having you back for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Monetary and fiscal measures by governments and central banks are inflating asset prices globally. As investors prepare for future inflation, demand for scarce real assets is rising. How does the 1% prepare for this? They invest in art. Masterworks.io is the first company that lets you invest in multi-million dollar paintings at a fraction of the cost from artists like Basquiat and Keith Haring. 84% of ultra-high net worth individuals collect art, according to a 2019 Deloitte survey. And it makes sense. According to Citi Private Bank, contemporary art returned 13.6% year over year in the last 25 years versus 8.9% for the S&P 500. Over the same period, art had the lowest correlation to the stock market of the 10 major asset classes. Masterworks.io is making art investing accessible to everyone, regardless of accreditation. Start diversifying your net worth today. Visit Masterworks.io to learn more. See important information at Masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Dylan on the show, but I'm looking forward to diving into the chart deck to kind of talk about how the rotation's been occurring in these equity markets.
Listeners, you'll find the download link for Patrick's chart deck in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. So just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads, just above Dylan's picture on the homepage. Patrick, sector rotation or bigger correction? Which is it?
Well, you know, I wanted to start off just by looking at page 2 in that S&P 500 chart, because what all of us have been seeing when just looking at the surface is a market that's been relatively flat. The S&P 500 more or less has been trading at the same price level for the better part of 2-3 weeks. And really, it looking just feels like the market is pausing, but there's something really big happening under the surface of the market. And I really wanted to use this chart book to kind of explore how there's this rotation happening and what conditions would change in order to make this into a bigger market correction. And so on page 3, what I have here is the chart of the NASDAQ. With that 50-day moving average on there, really I wanted to just use the 50-day to kind of highlight where the average price is and just to show the magnitude of the pullback on a relative basis. And what we can see is that while the S&P has been flat, the NASDAQ has been correcting over the last week, and we've more or less approached even close to a 50% retracement of that April, March-April rally. And we have the NASDAQ selling, and it's happening actually in a number of the subsectors within there, and particularly on page four, when we look at the, this is the FANG futures, which is all of the big behemoth tech companies like the Apples of the world in this ETF. And what's particularly interesting about the FANG stocks, that in spite of strength in Google and Facebook, we have not seen the FANGs in April manage to make it back to their previous highs the way the NASDAQ and the S&P has been able to. And more importantly, these FANG stocks have now fully rolled over and are trading well below their moving averages. And so we're continuing to see weakness in this tech space and distribution really coming in there. And that story continues. When we go to page five, we can see the SPAC ETF. And the SPACs have been one of the hottest bubble sectors in the market in the late last year, going into the first few months of this year. And really, since the February high, most SPACs have had a substantial and deep mean reversion, and they certainly have stopped really driving any of the momentum behind in this market. And we continue to see rotation out of there. And so this theme continues. For instance, on page six, when we talk about those stocks that did incredibly well when COVID came around and we had the big lockdowns, and so the Pelotons and the Zooms and all of these other stocks associated with everyone staying home and locking down, it had extraordinary runs in the summer of 2020. But I'm just using Zoom's chart here, but whether you're talking Peloton or any of these other ones, they have just been outright selling, and there's been full-on distribution in this entire space. And even another sector that's been aggressively distributed has been the social media space. I'm using here the social ETF, SOCL, and this social media ETF has really failed to be making higher highs and just been rolling over. And so we have this, while it looks like this S&P is holding up, what's really interesting is that this entire kind of tech space and NASDAQ space has really just stopped getting any money flow, any rotation. Even like ETFs like Cathie Wood's ARK investment has just been incredibly weak. Tesla has been incredibly weak. All of these stocks just have run out of all momentum.
Well, Patrick, something's holding this market up. So if those stocks are running out of momentum, let's take a look at the various different sector ETFs and figure out what's actually holding the market up. Let's start on page eight with the value ETF.
Right. And so one of those things, I mean, we talked about it last week when we were talking about momentum versus value when Charlie was on, but really I wanted to just highlight the actual value factor ETF, the VLUE. And what we continue to see is that the value stock basket continues to make 52-week highs and continues to get a momentum to the upside. As well, a space that has truly been some of the leadership is on page nine when we're looking at the metals and mining ETF, the XME, which has broken decisively to a fresh high. And whether you focus directly into spaces like uranium, or whether you go into those copper stocks, or you go zinc, or any of these other basic material metals, they've all just been doing incredibly well and continue to get substantial amounts of rotation as commodities such as iron ore commodity or steel or copper all are making fresh highs in this cycle. Now, let's move on to page 10, where there's another sector that has been doing incredibly well and taking quite a bit of rotation of the money, and that's the SPDR financial ETF, the XLF. Even when you're looking even at the KRE, which is the regional banks ETF, the financials also continue to get substantial rotation, and they continue to plug 52-week highs. And so while the S&P 500 is holding up here along these highs, under the hood, there's a very big rotation underway, and it doesn't seem to be slowing. And so really, it's about what is the right sectors to be in order to be making any performance in this market environment. Another place that's been incredibly hot on page 11 is looking at the home construction ETF, the ITB. Obviously, lumber prices have just gone absolutely parabolic to the upside, but that doesn't seem to have slowed down these home construction companies. companies, which continue to just plug along, doing very, very well, and including the energy space, which on page 12, we have that Spider Energy ETF, which is the XLE, and it's almost right back to those 52-week highs, ready to break out. And so the theme really continues to be that value and cyclical and financials are all getting all of this money flow, and anything associated with tech and FANG and SPACs and any of those things that were incredibly hot late last year into the start of the year continue to be actively distributed. And so back to the very question that we were asking at the very first slide, is this a sector rotation or the start of something bigger? I actually think we have to not take our eyes off of these value and cyclicals, because they're very mature and this move is already quite overbought. And I'm not trying to predict that they're imminently going to stop going up. But in order for this market to turn into like one of these bigger market corrections where the S&P 500 starts to really sell and mean revert at this big correction, we would need to start seeing highs coming in some of those cyclical spaces. And there's no sign of that yet. And so that's certainly something that I think we have to watch in the next week or two as to whether that space starts running out of momentum on the upside or whether this rotation just continues.
Well, that's what we need to watch. And for any listeners who want to watch it closely, you can get Patrick's service every single day, not just once a week, by signing up for a free trial of Big Picture Trading at bigpicturetrading.com. The information is on page 13. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks.io, bringing fine art investing within reach of all investors. Patrick, what can they expect to find in this week's research roundup?
You're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Dylan, as well as a link to the chart book that we just discussed here in the post game. You're also going to find a link to an oil price article on copper prices could double from here, as well as a link to a Bill Blaine article on failing global politics and inflation will be a nasty shock. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter @EricSTownson. That's Eric spelt with a K, and myself @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. The Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.